Hi, it's Lena Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today it's the fat that we hear so much about, the omega-3s. Science writer Susan Alport joins us. Her book title says it all, The Queen of Fats, Why Omega-3s Were Removed from the Western Diet, and What We Can Do to Replace Them. LA Times' Russ Parsons has the skinny on all those different spring peas and the overlooked fresh fava bean, the elemental things that get by us when we're not paying attention, like the Barolo wine controversy. Experts are turning themselves inside out over the big changes in the wine, Letty Teague tells all. Then it's a tale of little nippers and an addiction, as in Girl Scout cookies. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to you by Las Vegas. Vegas Uncorked brings chefs from around the world to town this May. More at VegasUncorked.com. The Sterns write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, you guys haven't mentioned barbecue in maybe 3 weeks. So, any new discoveries?
I can't say we discovered it, but I have to tell you that we have recently been at what may be the greatest barbecue anywhere.
You say that all the time.
No, I don't. No, look, all right, let me tell you this. It's the oldest barbecue anywhere, for sure. This place has roots that go back to 1830. When Skilton M. Dennis, who used to cook whole hogs in pits dug in the ground, brought some of his meat to sell at a Baptist convention. Dennis's like seventh or eighth generation progeny are now running the Skylight Inn and cooking the whole hogs over hickory coals exactly the way it's been done for maybe the last 100 or so years.
So there.
Okay.
This is
all
really
right.
A great barbecue.
And just for example, just to let you know how special this place is, there is no sauce on premises whatsoever. Bruce Jones told us that if there's sauce around, it's not real barbecue.
This place, Lynn, also has the greatest room tone in the world. You walk into it, and it's pretty much of a simple storefront with maybe five tables.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just absolutely as plain as can be. And there are people eating, they're not talking, and all you hear is chop, 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 because the man behind the counter, who is the pit master, has taken a big hunk of whole hog, and he's standing there with two cleavers and a wooden board that has a depression in it because he chops it all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all you hear is just, you know, people chewing and chop, 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 chop. There's no music. There's no talking. There's no goofing around. It's almost like going into a church, you know, sort of a barbecue church.
And let me tell you, one of the great things about whole hog barbecue is that what he's chopping is not just that tender shoulder meat or butt meat that you get in a regular barbecue.
Right.
You get that, but you also get those like crisp, chewy bits of skin, some of which are almost like hard. So the barbecue, it's hacked up enough so that you can eat it, but the texture of this barbecue is unbelievable. I mean, some is kind of fall apart velvet soft, other is like crisp and crunchy. And all he does with this meat that has been cooked for approximately 18 hours over hickory is that he occasionally will sprinkle on a little bit of vinegar and a little bit of Texas Pete brand hot sauce, salt and pepper. That's all that goes into it.
First of all, where is this place?
It's in Aden, North Carolina.
Now, is that up in the mountains or is that?
No, it's kind of east central North Carolina. You know, North Carolina itself has several dozen different styles of barbecue from the mountains to the ocean. This is really the prototype pretty much for what you will get in eastern North Carolina in the sense that sauce is anathema. However, what you won't get here that you will find in a lot of the favorite barbecue parlors further to the east is hush puppies, potatoes, anything else. The menu is chopped pork, coleslaw, cornbread. That's it.
That's it.
And the cornbread is in lieu of a plate. It's a very funny looking cornbread. It's a big, thin square of rather hard
unleavened
cornbread. And you're given a piece of wax paper with this square of unleavened cornbread on it and a hunk of barbecue on top of it. And I kept looking for the plate, but this is bare bones.
You can, if you, that's what Jane just described is called a tray. You can, if you wish, get a sandwich, in which case the barbecue and some of the really good coleslaw they make there is put inside of a bun. So that way you don't have to use the cornbread as a tray. But the cornbread, weird as it is really delicious. I mean, it's not fluffy. It's not sweet.
Right.
It's not, you know, cakey at all. It's kind of hard. I mean, it reminds us that this stuff does really date back a century and a half or more.
Hey, guys, thank you. Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
You can have your beans and greens. You can take your steaks and cakes. You can have your good beef too. But I'll take my barbecue. Well, 'cause I like barbecue. Hey, hey, good barbecue. Well, I love that stuff and my baby loves it too.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And speaking of websites, there are a couple of websites that have been kind of entertaining this week. Andrew, our brilliant intern, found foodcell.com. Now, this site gives you a visual image of the nutritional makeup of your food. They show calories as batteries, sugar as piles of sugar cubes, and fats as sticks of butter. And they cover everything from fresh broccoli to ethnic foods. It's the ethnic foods that really get interesting. These are not like any selections I've seen. There's no miso or curry. The foods are all Native American, mainly Alaskan, as in walrus liver and Augatuck. That's described as Alaskan ice cream made from fat and fish. These are fascinating. We never see these foods. Another website find, by the way, that's just fun to look at is on England's BBC site. It's Edible Landscapes by photographer Carl Warner. They're amazingly realistic. And you don't realize you're looking at food until you notice that that boulder in the foreground is a potato. And those balloons that are sailing through the air are really garlics and strawberries and onions. Well, we've put both sites up on our website, splendidtable.org. LA Times food and wine journalist Russ Parsons has been tracking American agriculture in his writings, well, for 20 years. In his latest book, he lays out how our food is grown, how it gets to us, and what we should do with it once we get it home. Russ Parsons is the author of How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. Russ, it's good to have you back.
Lynn, it's great to talk to you again.
Russ, I'm looking through the book, and I see you've got two complete chapters on what I think of as the spring jewels, fava beans and peas. But people don't know fava beans, so can you give us sort of an introduction?
Fava beans are kind of a cult vegetable out here in California. There's an argument that they could be the state vegetable because it's so precious. It's one of the first of the spring vegetables that we see in the farmers' markets, and it came about kind of accidentally. Farmers planted them because they're good for the soil, and so they would use them over winter. And then they started bringing them into the market to say, oh, well, maybe people will buy these. And, of course, people went crazy for them. It's a really delicious vegetable. It looks like a great giant pea pod. But when you open them up inside, the peas are flattened rather than being round. And yeah. The flavor is, they're not as sweet as English peas, but they're greener. And so if you think of the kind of, what we think of as pea flavor and take away this, take away some of the sweetness, that's what you get with a fava bean.
What's your philosophy on to peel or not to peel the fava bean?
That's a very thorny issue. And what it comes down to is size. When you're choosing fava beans, you want to try and choose the ones where you don't see the individual beans swelling through the pod. When the beans are that small, the little skin on them doesn't need to be peeled. If you can see the swelling of the individual beans,
yeah,
chances are that when you open them up and shuck the beans out of there, that they will be wrapped in a kind of translucent or even white skin. And that white skin is bitter and it needs to be peeled. The best way to do that, just collect all of the shucked beans in a bowl, pour boiling water over them, and then just sit and one at a time, you just squeeze them
yes.
through and get
yeah.
rid of all of the beans. It's a real problem, but the flavor makes up for it.
So how do you cook them? Or do you cook them?
You don't need to cook them. They're really terrific, especially when you get the really young ones. They're great just shucked and served with a salty cheese, like a pecorino romano or, feeling
yeah,
that. You can
yeah.
use a feta or something like that. Serve that as an appetizer with a really crisp white wine. That's a very nice spring dish. If you want to cook them, they don't need to cook very long. I mean, really, they'll cook in 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to something that is a little easier to get our hands on. Peas, but there are different kinds of peas, right?
There are different kinds of peas. The one that most people are probably familiar with is the English pea, and it's it comes in the big round pod. You shuck
right,
them, and
yeah.
If you're lucky, you get an amazing vegetable. It's sweet and it's green. It's spring all by itself. The problem is that English peas begin to lose their sugar almost as soon as they're picked. The sugar starts to turn to starch, and so even if it's like a perfect pea that's been perfectly refrigerated 2 days after picking, it's not anywhere close to what it was. They're just very, very fragile.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a couple of things that people have come up with to try and get around that. One of them, of course, is the snow pea, which I think everybody knows from, a thousand bad Chinese banquets. It's
right.
kind of the
yeah.
thin,
yeah.
flat thing. It's got some of the sweetness of a pea. It doesn't have much of the greenness. And because the texture is so fragile, just even a stir fry, you can lose the texture, the crispness of it. My favorite, call it a pea alternative, is the sugar snap pea. And this is actually an old vegetable that had basically gone out of favor and was reintroduced in 1979 by a University of Maryland professor named Calvin Lamborn. It immediately caught on. It looks just like an English pea.
Oh, yeah.
If you had the
yeah.
two side by side, you would have a hard time telling them apart, except that the pod is edible. You eat the whole thing. And they're very, very crisp and very, very sweet. They don't have quite as much of the green flavor as an English pea, but it's really, really close. And I think this is a great vegetable, and I use them all the time. The trick with cooking them, they're delicious raw, but the trick with cooking them is that you want to cook them very, very quickly so that you don't lose that crispness, which is so much a part of their charm.
Russ, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
LA Times food and wine journalist Russ Parsons is the author of How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. Now, you can find Russ's recipe for sugar snap pea soup with Parmesan cream on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out our other offerings, newsletters, podcasts, and the latest addition to our recipe box, Splendid Cheap Eats, a selection of some of the more inexpensive and inspiring recipes for you to make at home. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Coming up, the Queen of Fats, the Battle of Barolo, and Girl Scout cookies. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. We are a nation of deeply confused eaters. I mean, take fats, for instance. First, fats were good. Then they were bad. Now they're good again. At least, only certain ones are good. And I will bet there's another aspect of fats that you don't have a clue about. Did you know that the United States has an endangered fat? A fat that is nearly extinct, at least in our bodies. Well, this is the premise behind food and health writer Susan Allport's new book. It's called The Queen of Fats, Why Omega-3s Were Removed from the Western Diet, and What We Can Do to Replace Them. Susan, welcome.
Hello, Lynn.
Well, I think we've got to look at this first to find out, what are you talking about when you say an omega-3? We hear this a lot, but what does this really mean?
Well, omega-3s are one of two families of essential fats, and those are fats that we cannot make ourselves and must consume in our diets. And interestingly, the omega-3s are, in fact, the most abundant fat on the planet because they are in the green leaves of plants.
Uh-huh.
The only place where they're nearly extinct is in the tissues of Americans. And that's because these two families compete for positions in our cell membranes. And once we started eating huge amounts of seed oils, which are much richer in that competing omega-6 fat, we effectively reduced the omega-3s in all of our tissues.
Okay, so you have threes and the sixes. How do they each function?
There are just small differences in structure between these two families of fats, but we've learned that there are large differences in function. In short, the omega-3s speed up the activity of all the cells in our body, and the omega-6s slow down that activity slightly. The omega-3s produce very little inflammation and blood clotting. The omega-6s produce quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
What's important is having a balance of these two families of fats in the membranes for optimal activity and health. Omega-3s are found throughout the body, but they're particularly concentrated in our brains and our eyes, so all sorts of mental disorders and visual disorders are linked to a deficiency of omega-3s in our tissues. And then, because omega-6s are so much more inflammatory than omega-3s, all the inflammatory disorders, of which there are many, in fact, that may underlie most of our diseases, are being linked to this imbalance of the two families of essential fats.
What is the right balance then?
We actually need more omega-6s in our diet than we do omega-3s. Currently, we're thinking that we need about a 4-to-1 ratio of the 6s to 3s. Most Americans at this time have about a 10-to-1 ratio or a 20-to-1 ratio. That's what we don't need. We need to get down to about a 4-to-1. And interestingly, that produces about a 50-50 ratio in the body itself.
So the way the body absorbs those two separate omega-3s and omega-6 fats.
Right.
So how do we get there?
How do we get there? The simplest thing is to change the vegetable oils that you're using to cook with. That's the basic one. Fortunately, not all seeds have the same ratios of very high amounts of sixes and very low amounts of threes. The canola oil happens to have a 2-to-1 ratio of sixes to threes. Walnut oil has about a ratio of 5-to-1 sixes to threes. So those are healthy oils to use. Olive oil is a good oil not because it has a lot of threes, but because it doesn't have a lot of sixes. So that's still a great oil to use. And even butter doesn't have large amounts of those sixes in it. Our problems began when we started switching to the corn oil, the soybean oil, safflower, sunflower oil, where the ratios are 50-to-1 or 250-to-1. And that's completely upset the balance in our tissues.
And any other ways?
Next is to increase your consumption of animals that have in turn eaten greens because their tissues, their eggs, their milk will be much richer in the threes and will have many fewer of the sixes in them.
So you're talking then about animals that are not grain-fed but animals that are grass-fed.
Exactly. We've changed the feeding of our animals and we didn't realize that we were really making profound changes in their tissues at the same time. The omega-3 enriched eggs, I love that story because all eggs used to be omega-3 enriched when the chickens that laid them were out foraging and eating green leaves and bugs. We've turned them into omega-3 deficient eggs. We've changed a huge part of the food supply without knowing what we were doing.
Well, Susan, thank you.
You're welcome.
Science writer Susan Allport is author of The Queen of Fats, Why Omega-3s Were Removed from the Western Diet and What We Can Do to Replace Them. Letty Teague is a contributing wine editor to Food & Wine magazine. Her beat is essentially the world. Her prism often is how wines are evolving in a world where technology is in overdrive and change challenges tradition. Letty, welcome.
Hey, thanks. Good to be here.
You did a piece on Italy's Barolo wine, and I want to talk about some of the interesting questions you raised in the piece. But First, could you give us some backdrop, like geography and exactly what is Barolo?
Okay. Well, geographically, Barolo is in the Piemonte, a.k.a. Piedmont region of Italy. Mm-hmm. It's in the northwest corner. Barolo is actually the name, both the name of a town and the name of a wine region. The name of the grape that goes into Barolo is actually Nebbiolo.
Well, one of the things you say in the piece is evidently this has been considered the king of wine in Italy. And is it still the king?
Well, that's the $6 million question, or whatever price could be put on the collective worth of Barolo in the world. But I think that, you know, historically, it's always been considered the greatest wine of Italy, you know, because there weren't very many great wines. You could probably fairly say that Brunello and Barolo were really the two great wines in Italy.
And Brunello coming from Tuscany, right?
Maybe the 70s. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, what's happened now that you're actually having to ask the question?
Well, there's been a real stylistic shift in Barolo over the past couple decades. There's a schism between two types of producers, the modernist and the traditionalist. And it's sort of like the holy wars, you know, once upon a time. You know, there are some very strong feelings as to which style is the best. And just to back up and say that once upon a time, Barolo was made in a very traditional fashion, which is, you know, made in very large oak Slavonian casks, aged for a long time. What it did was actually produce a wine that could be fairly austere and fairly tannic, and it'd take a long time to come around. But today's wines are, you know, so many of the wines of the world are much more fruit-forward. People are used to having a certain kind of wine, which is a wine that's immediately pleasurable and immediately drinkable. And the winemakers who now identify themselves as modernists adopted various techniques to create wines that would be easier to drink. You know, the fruit was ripe and longer. They were put into small French oak barrels called barriques. Mm-hmm. So that's, you have a difference in wood. You also have a difference in aging. They weren't aged as long. So, you know, you have a very definite stylistic difference between the two wines, and a lot of controversy surrounding that difference, because they're saying, you know, these modern wines are not what Barolo is meant to be. And they're saying, well, you know, a lot of these techniques that the modernists have employed weren't around, you know, 30 years ago. So, you know,
it's like the natural evolution.
Exactly.
But I guess big question is, first of all, is this, can you still call the wine Barolo? And is what's behind this also economic sense? I mean, if you have to wait, from what I understand, Barolos can live for 20 years and very happily. So you invest in something and you're not going to reap any reward for somewhere between a decade and two decades.
Or you're not going to reap any pleasure. This is to say, you know, people drink wines young. I mean, that's just the way certainly Americans do. Well, most people do. And most wines are meant to be drunk young. But the question is, if you buy, how many people are going to buy a wine and put it away? You know, the answer is not many. And to back up on the other end, because that's on the consumer end, but on the producer end, how long do you want to keep your wine in barrel, which is to say wait to make money? So, you know, how many producers have the capital wherewithal and the patience to wait it out, to wait the 5 years to put a wine in the market?
So from one point of view, can you say this is the beginning of Barolo disappearing?
No, because, you know, there's still a lot of traditionalists working in Barolo, and there's actually – there's been a shift in that the modernists are coming away, you know, from some of the modern techniques. They're shifting back to the large oak cast. There's not as much emphasis on barrique. So there's actually been, if anything, you know, more coming to the center. Some of the traditionalists are taking their wines out of barrel sooner. So there has been some level of compromise. So I think it will be interesting to see what happens in, like, the next 10 years, you know. But because Barolo will always be Barolo, first of all, because it's a geographic region. But as far as the understanding of what the wine is, you know, like so many wines of the world, a lot has changed, you know, of the way the wine is made. So to say Barolo is X and Air shall be, you know, isn't true any more than it is what is Bordeaux and what is Burgundy and what were they and what have they become?
Could you name some names for us? For instance, one or two of the real traditionalist style, and then maybe one or two of the newer style. So if we wanted to taste the difference, it would be quite easy for us to do it.
Sure. Well, Bruno Giacosa is the arch traditionalist, and he's considered the just the godfather of all great traditional Barolo. He also makes Dynamite Barbaresco. Giacomo Borgogno is another traditionalist whose wines I like a lot and find very appealing. The modernist Luciano Sandrone makes just phenomenal wines. His Canubi Boscius, which is a single vineyard bottling, is out of this world. It's also wildly expensive, which there's another, and as are the wines of Scavino, also quite expensive. But Sandrone is sort of the holy grail of the modernist, and I've been lucky enough to taste some Scavino wines with friends who have cellars and pockets deep enough to pay well. They once upon a time upon release maybe it was $150, but you know, some of these wines can cost $500 a bottle.
So it's the mortgage payment, or it's
or having well-heeled and generous friends.
One must cultivate, I gather.
Yes.
Is there anything?
But not to do it so obviously that one's intention is simply to drink their wines, but to enjoy their friendship.
Well, perchance, is there anything perhaps a tad less expensive that one could taste to get a sense of the new style?
Sure. Clerico is a modernist that makes good wines and for under $100, which may sound kind of outrageous, but is considered reasonable in the world of Barolo. And same with Borgogno, who I mentioned. His wines could be $50, $60 a bottle. The 01s are the vintage to look for in my books. The 04 vintage, which is coming out, is rumored to be spectacular. I don't know what the prices are. They haven't been set yet. You can imagine they aren't going to be cheap. But they'll certainly be cheaper now than they will be, you know, when those wines come to maturity.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Letty Teague's article on Barolo appeared in the September 2007 issue of Food & Wine magazine. For Letty's Barolo suggestions, check out the website, splendidtable.org. Part of being human is having a profound need to belong. Now, that need can take us to the dark places, into the kinds of experiences that writers build their careers on, like commentator Julie Houserman.
Hello, my name is Julie, and I'm an addict. Back when it started, I was just trying to fit in. I was working at the newspaper, and my coworker was pushing this stuff for her kid. I know, it sounds bad, it really does. But the kid came in one day, and she had these button eyes and this gap-toothed smile. She really needed the money, you know? I forked over the cash. So did everybody else. Before long, I had the stuff stashed in my desk and at home. There were Thin Mints in the freezer, Samoas in the pantry, Tagalongs in the car. It got to where I got nervous when they started to run out. But they come back every year like clockwork. Just when your pants finally fit for the first time since Thanksgiving, Girl Scout cookies arrive. 10 years ago, I had a baby girl, and now she's a Girl Scout, and I'm sitting here with a stack of cartons to supply the entire neighborhood. I didn't push her into it. I swear to God, it was her own idea. This year, her dad spent $122 on cookies. I spent $40. Normally, I avoid store-bought cookies altogether. I mean, a cookie's not that hard of a thing to make. But the combination of uber-cute salespeople and addictive secret ingredients makes Girl Scout cookies irresistible. I am not the only addict listening here today. Under normal circumstances, like at the grocery store, you'd buy just one box of cookies. But when it comes to Girl Scout cookies, you're just a spoiler if you buy just one box. You're a stingy cheapskate disappointing the little nippers with green sashes and pigtails. To be a good citizen, you need to buy 5 boxes, or 6, or 20, to make sure the troop has the bucks to make it to Animal Kingdom. So, here I sit. All day long, the Thin Mints call to me. And I won't deny it. When I eat them, I'm comforted. I can hear them right now calling me. I'm getting up. I'm going in there. I'm going to eat just one.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, you know.
Julie Hazerman is a freelance writer who stashes her Girl Scout cookies in her home in Tallahassee. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what movement in China has mega corporations like IBM inviting Greenpeace into their company cafeterias? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. We're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But right now, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what movement in China has mega corporations like Intel inviting Greenpeace into their company cafeterias? Well, the movement is against disposable chopsticks. The Wall Street Journal reported that the Chinese go through 63 billion pairs of disposable wooden chopsticks each year. No self-respecting environmentalist is going to let that one go by. Groups like Greenpeace claim that Chinese forests are endangered. Pop stars and political types have joined up too. The pressure has been so great that IBM, Intel, Microsoft, and other businesses have invited Greenpeace people to talk about the situation in one of the thousands of places where the chopsticks are used every day, company cafeterias. Of course, there is a backlash. The disposable chopstick industry says that the sticks come from fast-growing woods. And then there's the health side of the question. According to the article, disposable means safe in a country where there have been a lot of health scares. Yet BYOC is the new trend, that is, bring your own chopsticks. And since China has a tradition of handsome handmade sticks, who knows? There may be a revival of the local mom-and-pop chopstick maker. Okay, it is time to turn to our callers. Get to those phones. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's calling? We have got Mary calling from Buffalo. Mary, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. How are you? I want to talk about knives. My niece is a sophomore at Siena College in New York, and she's doing her undergraduate degree in nutrition and business. And then she'd like to get her master's in nutrition and then go to cooking school. And I thought it would be a great idea to get her a set of knives. And I told her to go out and handle all the knives and everything, but I was wondering, would you recommend a certain knife for a manufacturer, or what should she look for?
You gave her great advice, because the first thing you want to do is handle. You want to know that the ergonomics work for you and the balance is right. It's a thorny subject, because there are so many variety of knives. This is an area of kitchen tools that has exploded in the past 5 or 6 years. I guess there's a tacky question. How much do you want to spend?
Well, what I was thinking is each Christmas that goes, I could get her a knife.
And, all right, so
you know, so it's not going to be spent all in one.
Right, right. Frankly, by the way, what she really needs, what she will use from day to day, at least for my money, is three knives: an 8-inch chef's knife,
8-inch chef's, okay,
a 4-inch parer,
uh-huh,
and a 6 or 7-inch all-purpose knife, and that tends to look a little like a scaled-down chef knife.
Okay.
But the blade, I just find I use that knife all the time. Now, a slicing knife is wonderful, you know, for meat and that kind of thing. But two things. First of all, there are two German brands of knives that are the classics. They're Wusthof and Henkel. Okay. Now, these are high carbon stainless steel. Now, what does that mean? It means that this is not a knife that's going to rust, but yet it has been tempered and treated in a way that it's soft enough that you can sharpen it. Because you probably know, a knife that they say never needs sharpening, it's going to be dull forever. You need a knife that's soft enough to be sharpened, that will hold its edge for a period of time, and that can achieve a really, really great edge.
Okay.
So I would say Henkel or Wusthof, and there are many, many, they have different levels of knives. She should handle them. She should get a feel for them.
Okay.
Okay, so those are two brands to look at. Now, the big deal is Japanese knives, and Japanese knives can be a mortgage payment.
They're sort of popular now.
They are, and they can be phenomenal knives, but their shapes are different than what we're used to, and perhaps not as versatile. But there's a couple of knives that she can find in good kitchen stores that she might want to handle. The brand that I'm most familiar with is Shun, S-H-U-N. There are other brands as well, but I've handled these knives and I like them a lot. Now, there is a chef-style knife that they have. It is designed by a chef named Ken Onion. Appropriate name. I think he made it up. And this knife is very unusual. The ergonomics on this knife are incredible. It's actually a handle that is shaped in a way that you can choke up, you know, come up and almost be hanging on to the end of the blade. There's a place for your thumb. I love this knife because of what it does for my hands.
Okay.
And it has a curved blade. So when you're rocking to cut, it just makes you feel so comfortable. Now, this knife actually comes in its own wooden cradle.
Okay.
It's around $230.
Okay.
And that's one that she must handle first. If you're thinking of even, you know, offering that kind of thing to her, she's got to feel like it's the knife to have.
Okay.
They have several lines, just like the other makers, you know, of different knives. One of the things that I find is these knives are razor sharp, and you can sharpen them yourself, but they are, I think, such precision instruments. They're made in a very complex way, and they offer a service which I take advantage of. You can ship those knives back to the importer here in the United States, and they will sharpen them for you. For nothing.
Right.
Also, the other thing about these knives is there's a guarantee on them. If anything happens to them, they'll be replaced for a lifetime.
Okay.
So the Japanese knives, very high end. She must really be comfortable with them. Not all of them have great ergonomic handles, but the Ken Onion does. But I think it's a great gift, and I hope this helps you.
Oh, I'm sure it does.
There is a website that has some really good basic information about what to look for in a knife. It's called cutlery.com.
Great. Thanks so much, Lynn.
Hey, you are welcome. And what a lovely gift to give to her.
Bye.
You take care.
Bye.
I have to tell you, the way it worked in our family was that for every birthday and Christmas from the time I was born, I had an aunt who very generously gave me a place setting of silver The reality was, if it had been a dynamite knife, I probably would have loved it more. Ungrateful person that I am. 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next? We have got David calling from Nashville. Hey, David, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am very good, sir. And what is on your mind?
Well, I spring in about 95 or 96, I happened across some morel mushrooms. I wasn't even looking for them, and I found them. And just delicious, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Butter and garlic.
Mm-hmm.
And, but ever since then, I've gone out on purpose to look for them, and I just haven't had any luck. But I'm calling you with the mindset that this spring is going to be different. I'm going to get an earlier start, and I'm just going to,
you're going to hunt.
Enjoy the bounty if I can find it anyway. And I guess my question is, when it comes to something like morels, do the basics apply? You know, would they be nice with a piece of fish?
Oh, I see. You mean, you know, what in so many words, what's going to show them off best?
To get the most out of the flavor, yes.
Yeah. Well, you're on the right track, because I think morels are not overwhelming. They're flavorful. They're delicious. They're nutty. I don't know. I always think of them, it's a silly way to describe them, but they're mushroomy. Do you know what I mean? They're all of the things. They taste to me always of the earth. They remind me of the aroma you get in the autumn of dried leaves. You know, I always think of that's part of the taste of a morel and the nuttiness. But you don't want to overwhelm them, and they can easily be overwhelmed. So you're right about delicately flavored fish, poultry, a very simple preparation. So, for instance, anything in the bass family.
Okay.
Snapper. You know, even though salmon's very rich, salmon and morel is not a bad thing. Not a bad thing at all.
Okay.
Rub the fish with black pepper and butter, or black pepper and olive oil, and then coarse salt. And do a slow grill. And while that fish is slowly grilling, because that means it's going to cook very slowly, and it's going, you're not going to lose any of the juices. You know, it's going to be fabulously moist.
Right.
In a saute pan, take a little olive oil and a little butter. All right.
Okay.
Then throw in some sliced shallots and maybe 3 branches of thyme.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah, because the thyme is going to just speak to those morel like very few herbs can. And what you'll do then is you'll add your morel and you'll do a very fast sauté on the morel. You want to still keep that little bit of crispness to them. And you'll get all of that flavor. And the shallot has garlic and it has onion, but it's gentle. And right. So then you can set that aside for a few moments. When your salmon is done, you put the salmon on the plate, sprinkle some lemon juice over it, and then around it, arrange all of those morels. If you have any chopped salted hazelnuts that do not taste stale, I stress that because, no, hazelnuts go stale in 4 seconds. It's just, I don't know what it is, but I see people using them in recipes and they haven't tasted them. And so they've wasted all that time and that beautiful cake they spent a fortune on tastes like spoiled nuts.
Right.
At any rate, point being, hazelnuts are a dynamite combination with morels, as are pine nuts. So that's the basic idea. I mean, another thing you could do is take a breast of chicken, pound it out thin, almost like a veal cutlet.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could season that very lightly with allspice and black pepper. And again, the idea of using a little bit of olive oil, and you could sear that on the grill. And then you could do the morel with lemon zest. And I like thyme. I'm in a thyme period. You should know that right now. I mean, I'm doing a lot of thyme. But you could do lemon zest and basil or lemon zest and thyme. In this case, I would use either olive oil or butter, but a delicate oil. You don't want an oil that's going to hit them over the head. This time I would use garlic, and that would be the basic thing that you would then put over the top of that flattened out, tender, and melt-in-the-mouth chicken.
Aha.
So keep it really simple.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, hey, Lynn, I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And I want to be able to call you next fall for about hen of the woods mushrooms.
You got it. You got it. You got a date. And I'm sending you great mojo. You're going to have fabulous luck with the morels.
I hope so. And and I'll let you know how those turn out. And
okay.
I do appreciate it.
All right. Go and feast. Go forth and feast.
All right. Bye now.
Bye. You take care, David.
Bye.
You can reach us, 800-537-5252. We have Bill calling from Calabasas, California. Hey, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I've taken up doing some baking over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
I learned how to cook when I was a child out of self-defense. My mother wasn't a good cook, and that's tough when you come from a Jewish family in New York City.
I have to, a quick side story of my husband is from, born and raised in New York City, and one of his pals went into the army and came home raving about the food because, and he hadn't realized it was the first time in his life he had not had heartburn.
I understand that tremendously. I do. I started baking scones.
Uh-huh.
I was very unhappy with what I found commercially in coffee houses.
Right.
And now have a reputation among all my friends as the scone maker. And everybody wants to know if I'm making scones each weekend so
That's
they can
great.
Kind of drop by.
That's great.
And I'm having a great time with it. And what I did is I adapted a Joy of Cooking recipe to my own tastes.
All right. Okay.
And I don't know a lot about the chemistry of cooking. I do of baking, and I do know, however, that if you take some of the elements out of balance, you really mess things up big time.
Mm-hmm. But I have to say, a scone is pretty forgiving. But go on. What are you thinking
about? I've been doing sweet scones.
Right.
Dried fruit. Blueberry with lemon zest in it is my favorite.
Mm-hmm. Sounds pretty good.
And
yeah.
I do ginger, and I do fresh apple with cinnamon.
Ooh.
And I do mixed dried fruits, and I've done, I've experimented with a lot of different
mm-hmm.
dried fruits. Mostly.
So now what do you want to try?
I want to try savory scones.
Piece of cake.
Is it? Okay. I'd love to do something to serve with a meal, or even as a small little, baked into small little pieces as an appetizer.
It would be, you could do it, this is the way I look at a scone. To me, a scone is a variation on a biscuit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because the way you make it, let's just make sure we're both on the same page. The dry ingredients go into a bowl. You cut in the fat.
Yep.
And you have some leavening in that dry ingredients.
Yep.
Then you add liquid. You work it very, very delicately, and then you shape it and bake it.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly.
And you add whatever flavoring ingredients you've got.
My first time out, I worked it a little too hard, and they became little hard stones.
Yeah, and that's what you use for a doorstop. You never waste anything.
Right.
Okay. If you cut way back on the sugar, yes, you're right. If you did that in a cake recipe, you'd have to go back to the drawing board.
Mm-hmm.
But here, you generally don't. And the reason I say this is I haven't done it in a long time, but I used to fool around with biscuits all the time. I'd make them with a lot of butter. I'd always kept the leavening and the flour, you know, in the proportion that I always used. Sometimes they had sugar, sometimes they didn't. I would throw fresh herbs in. I'd throw sautéed onion in. I used to do one where I did scallion and basil and, as I recall, shredded orange zest. It's one of my all-time favorites anyway. You know, roasted garlic, all of that. It always works. You can increase and decrease the fat to a certain point, and it'll work. Obviously, you have a lot of fat. It's going to be a heavier,
right.
richer.
I was concerned about when I'm moving from fruit to something like, say, for instance, prosciutto and a little Romano cheese or something.
I don't think it's going to be a problem.
It's not going to change the moisture?
Well, it may change the moisture. You know, sugar does add moisture.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, does your recipe have an egg in it by any chance?
It does.
It does.
I have a half cup of cream and an egg, and I throw in some vanilla.
Okay, instead of the vanilla,
mm-hmm.
first of all, you may want to increase the salt very, very slightly.
Okay.
And then, but wait a minute, if you're using Romano and prosciutto, you don't. No, because they've got plenty of salt all in there.
Right.
Keep it as, I would just withdraw the sugar,
mm-hmm.
keep everything else the same, cut up those ingredients in small pieces, or in the case of the cheese, grate it, and go for it. I don't think you're going to have a major problem.
No.
It may change consistently slightly, but it's going to be, you know, that happens when you do it with the fruit, because some fruit's wetter, some's dry, you know, that
yeah,
kind of thing.
But if I lose all that sugar in terms of volume and weight, is that going to make a...
I don't think it's going to make a huge difference. And by the way, the other thing is you could still keep a tablespoon or so of sugar in there. It will not hurt it. I would put a little minced onion in, too.
Mm.
That's me. But then again, there's nothing I would not
bad.
Add. Yeah, exactly.
Nothing bad about onion.
Hey, go forth and make great scones.
I'm looking forward to it.
You take care.
Thanks for the advice, and thanks for the show.
Hey, thank you for calling.
Bye.
Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. You can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week, and until next time, let me leave you with this quote from America's first modern restaurant critic, Duncan Hines. He said, "If the soup had been as warm as the wine, if the wine had been as old as the turkey, if the turkey had had a breast like the maid, it would have been a swell dinner." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported in part by Las Vegas. Vegas Uncorked brings chefs from around the world to town May 7th through 10th. You can see them in firsthand cooking demonstrations and taste their creations at parties at Vegas resorts and restaurants. VegasUncorked.com. Information on nearly everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Not only will you find our newsletter and podcasts, you'll find information on our book, How to Eat Supper. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our program is supported by the Repossessing Virtue Project, fresh thinking on the moral, spiritual, and ethical aspects of the economic downturn. Gain perspective on living and working at speakingoffaith.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.